Open your Bibles up to the book of Ruth. We are in chapter 3 now, our study of Ruth. We've made a transition. Chapter 1 primarily dealt with Ruth and Naomi and Orpah and her husband and sons all in the land of Moab. Then in chapter 2, it finds Ruth and Naomi in the fields of Bethlehem. And so now in chapter 3, Boaz and Naomi are going to work out their marriage, and she's going to propose, and so all this is going to transpire in chapter 3. So it's a transitional change in our study, and I want to talk to you tonight from the first five verses. I picked up my title. I'm not exactly sure where I got it, but it's not original to me. The title of my message is called Righteousness in Action. And I think we have to attribute that to John Piper. I'm not 100% certain of that, but somewhere in reading online and researching this last week, somebody made a statement, and I think it was John Piper, that said these five verses refer to righteousness in action. And I began to think about that, and it stuck with me, and I couldn't get it out of my head. I tried to focus the message on something different than that, but the more and more I looked at the first five verses, the more and more I became stuck on righteousness in action. And I really think it did belong to Piper. I'm not sure. I just read a couple, a little kind of an abbreviation, and I'm pretty sure they said Piper called this righteousness in action. So I give him credit for it if it's him. If it's not, then whoever it is, I give them credit for it. But as I looked at these five verses, I began to realize that, yes, these five verses show us how the righteous are to act. Now, here's the difference between righteousness in action and righteousness that is passive. We all can identify with a passive righteousness. A passive righteousness would be described this way. Well, I don't cuss. I don't get drunk. I don't murder. I don't steal. I don't commit adultery. Any of these things we would say I don't. Well, by not doing them, you are passively righteous. And if you were to tell me that and all that would be true of you, I would say, well, you know what? You're a pretty righteous person. You don't do any of these bad things. But the question that needs to be answered is, what do you do? What do you do? It's one thing to say, I don't, I don't, I don't. You know the old saying, I like to kind of throw it out as often as I can. We don't smoke and we don't chew and we don't go with the girls that do, right? Well, that's a bunch of passive righteousness. The question that needs to be asked is, what are you doing? There are a lot of churches and church members who do nothing. But what you do also dictates your righteousness. You can, think about it this way, you cannot do a lot of bad stuff, and the stuff that you do is bad. It's not so much what you do, but oftentimes it's how you go about it, how you do it. Have you ever heard the old saying, you could do the right thing the wrong way? That's very true, especially among Christians. Sometimes we take our command to preach the truth to its extreme, and we preach the truth, but we don't preach it out of love for the brethren. We don't preach it out of love for the lost. You can win an argument, but is winning the argument the right thing to do? You can pull your Bible out and wield it like a sword, but unless your aim is for correction out of love, it does no good. So here, we're going to look at righteous action. In these five verses, each of these verses give us a different action, a different plan, a different thought. And I want to look at each individual verse tonight. And I don't want to spend so much time dealing with the grammatical structures of the verses as much as I want to deal with the practical application of each verse. Let's look at what these two women did, and let's look at what Naomi instructed Ruth to do in these five verses, and let's take some principles away from each verse as to how you and I are to live. So, let's begin in verse 1 of chapter 3, and we'll read through verse 5. It says, Then Naomi, her mother-in-law, said unto her, My daughter, shall I not seek rest for thee, that it may be well with thee? And now is not Boaz of our kindred, with whose maidens thou wast? Behold, he winnoweth barley tonight in the threshing floor. Wash thyself, therefore, and anoint thee, and put thy raiment upon thee, and get thee down to the floor. But make not thyself known unto the man until he shall have done eating and drinking. And it shall be when he lieth down that thou shalt mark the place where he shall lie, and thou shalt go in and uncover his feet and lay thee down, and he will tell thee what thou shalt do. And she said unto her, All that thou sayest unto me, I will do. Now the first verse that we're going to deal with, verse 1, I'm going to deal with it under the heading of provision. Provision. There is a time in which we realize we need to make provision for the future. And the text says there, it's very cut and dried, Naomi, her mother-in-law, said unto her, My daughter, shall I not seek rest for thee, that it may be well with thee? Naomi here has had a change of heart since we first saw her in Moab speaking to her daughter-in-laws. Remember what she told them when they all dwelt in Moab after Chilion and Malion had died, after Elimelech had passed away? She said, Go, my daughters, back to the land of your parents. Go back to mom and dad's house, your young ladies, find another husband. Because where I'm going, good Jewish men that I would seek to marry you would not be interested in marrying you because you're Moabites. And we're expressly forbidden from being around Moabites. And so this idea of saying to her, stay here. And you remember Orpah, her sister-in-law, after she argued a little bit, she went back to Moab, back to her parents' house. But Ruth said, if I go to Bethlehem and I die in Bethlehem and I never marry again, that's okay with me. Because what was the most important thing to Ruth? It was Naomi, the only godly person she's ever known. It was the God of Naomi, the only true God, and the God that she believed in. And so in order to serve the God she believed in, she followed her mother-in-law back to Bethlehem, even if it meant she never married again. And Ruth, going back with Naomi, Naomi gives no indication that she's going to try to find a husband for her there. As a matter of fact, Naomi seems to be of the impression, up until verse 1, there's not any hope of finding a husband for you. What changed? What changed Naomi's mind? What made her, in verse 1 of chapter 3, all of a sudden say, Should I not find rest for you? That word rest, your Bible may translate it security. Other versions use the word security. Some use rest. But the word really means to settle down, to find safety, to find security, to find peace. So what Naomi is recognizing here is, should I not find a husband for you to settle down with? I mean, here's a nice looking lady. Here's a lady with great characteristics. Here's a lady that's well loved. Here's a young woman in her prime that should be married. Here's a woman that men find desirable. When Boaz first met her, he went up to her and he said, All of Bethlehem knows about your character and what a great woman you are for coming back here with your mother-in-law. This would have been a very desirable woman. And here Naomi says, Should I not seek rest for you? The only thing that changed her mind was the goodness of God to Ruth while she gleaned the fields of Boaz. Remember that first night when she come carrying home that ephah of barley, about a 40-pound sack of barley on her shoulder? She said, My stars, child, where'd you get all that at? I got it in one field, gleaning in the field of Boaz. Well, Boaz is our kindred. And then what did Ruth say? He told me not to go to anybody else's field. He gave me food. He gave me water. He offered me protection. And he said, If you'll glean in this field, you'll never have to go anywhere else for food. And then in the last verse of chapter 2 in verse 23, it says, She kept fast by the maidens of Boaz and gleaned to the end of barley harvest and of the wheat harvest. and dwelt with her mother-in-law. Now think about this. Here was the lady who, when she came back from Moab, said, "Don't call me Naomi," which means pleasant. She said, "Call me Mara," which means bitter, "because the Lord hath dealt bitterly with me." And when they went out to harvest barley, Naomi doesn't say, "Let's go glean." Naomi just sits there in a state of depression as if she's waiting to die. Sometimes people get bad news and that's what they do. "Well, I'll just sit here and die." But the goodness of God to Ruth in honoring her effort changed the heart and changed the attitude of Naomi. And now Naomi says, "I need to go find you a husband." And guess what? That would have been Naomi's place to do so. Naomi should have helped Ruth. How would Ruth know who a godly man is? The only godly person she's ever known up until wheat harvest or barley harvest is Naomi. Who does Ruth know in Bethlehem outside of Naomi? Shouldn't Naomi be the one as her parental protector? The one that she's honoring, the one that Ruth says, "I'm going to follow you and do as you do and follow your God and you're going to be my leader." Shouldn't Naomi as the leader say, "I need to find you a husband. I need to find a kinsman redeemer. Not just any old boy down the street. I need to find someone from our family. Someone who can provide a child for you, because if that child is born unto you, all of Elimelech's land that we left here when we went to Moab would go back to you. Shall I not find security? Shall I not find rest?" What's the moral of verse 1 in provision? Provision means that you're preparing for the future. You're not going to get prepared for the future until your attitude at the here and now gets changed. Your action's not going to get right until your attitude is right. We can get up and demand that lost people repent of their sins and trust in the Lord Jesus Christ till we're blue in the face and they're deaf. But until they get a different attitude toward God and Jesus Christ as their Redeemer and their own sin, nothing's going to transpire. Right? It's not a matter of they don't have the information. It's a matter of they don't have the appetite. The attitude. You see, you must understand, it's not until the heart gets right that the needs and what needs to be done are actually acted upon. So what begins our salvation? Our action or the Spirit's work in our heart? Bingo. When the Spirit begins to work in the heart of man, what happens? Man falls under conviction. Now, how long is man going to stay under that conviction? Only God knows. For Naomi, she was in a spirit of depression. And it wasn't until God began to pour His blessing, pour His blessing, pour His blessing, that she said, "Hey, we got to take some action. We can be passively righteous and sit here and not do anything wrong, but we need to be actively righteous. We need to make provision for what lays in store." Now, verse 2, I want to deal with our second thought, the period. And I don't mean punctuation mark, I mean period of time. Verse 2 says this, "And now is not Boaz our kindred, with whose maidens thou wast? Behold, he winnoweth barley tonight in the threshing floor." The period of time. The verse begins with, "and now." We need to figure out when now is. Now, some translators believe, to be the very first night. The night that she went out and gleaned in the field, she came back. And Naomi said, "Change your clothes, wash up, anoint yourself, go back down there. Boaz is a kindred of ours. That's the guy to marry." And verse 23 of chapter 2 is a parenthesis. She went down, did that, and then she worked in the fields harvesting barley and wheat. Now, some people say that since he's with his maidens and he's winnowing barley, well, there was the barley harvest, then there was the wheat harvest. And so this had to have happened before the wheat harvest. And between the beginning of barley harvest and the end of wheat harvest is about 3 months. So it must have been 6 weeks after they arrived, because it's at the end of barley harvest. So would it have been the very night? Would it have been 6 weeks later? Or would it have been at the end of both barley and wheat harvest? It could have been any of the three. I lean toward being at the end of the barley and wheat harvest. Because I believe if Boaz and Naomi are married, if Boaz and Ruth are married, they're not, Ruth's no longer living with Naomi. Not while she's gleaning in the field. And if Boaz is the legal husband of Ruth, why is he making her pick up scraps in the field? Why isn't she getting a wife's portion? You see, I believe that this marriage takes place at the end of both the barley and the wheat harvest. Well, why is he winnoweth barley? Well, there's only one threshing floor in the city of Bethlehem, and everybody uses it. And to winnoweth means to toss up in the air and let the wind blow away. That's what winnoweth means. So when you look at the text, it says he winnoweth barley tonight. Now, as we said earlier in our study, there's two actions that have to be accomplished before you get barley to eat. Number one, you've got to get barley off the stalk. Number two, you've got to get barley out of its hull or its husk. So to do one, you would throw it up in the air. To do the other, you would tread it underfoot. To get it off the stalk, you might throw it up in the air. To get it off the hull, you might have to tread it underfoot. Have you ever heard someone say their cow is treading corn? By treading corn, what they're doing is they're taking the kernels off the ears. When you do one, you throw it up in the air and you let the chaff and you let the straw blow away. When you do the other, you have to press that husk in order to break it loose. You have to beat it. So we talked about with her, when she beat out the barley, she pulled the ears off the stalks, and then she had to take a rod or a big heavy leather strip and beat those husks. Or you might see women sometimes in the islands where they have a thing like this that comes up, and they got a big poker, a big pounder, and they're pounding down in a little deal. What they're doing is they're breaking the hulls off rice. Then they turn it over and the heavier rice grains fall out. You toss it up in the air and the chaff blows away. So if he's winnoweth barley, he must be at the end of harvest. Now, as we said, this threshing floor would be a community threshing floor. You know what that means? Everybody didn't have their own threshing floor. Number one, you had to do it in a high spot where you had wind. You couldn't go do it back behind the church where you're blocked on three sides. You remember Gideon in Judges chapter 6? He was threshing wheat in a wine press so the Midianites wouldn't see it. Now, that's dumb. You get in a wine press where there is no wind, and you try to fluff up the wheat and let the seeds stay and the chaff blow away. That's a hard way to do it. The only way you would do that is if you're scared somebody would see you on a hilltop throwing wheat up in the air, and then they would come and charge you and take over. So what's happening here in this period of time is it's more than likely, since it's a community place, you get in line. And when you can harvest wheat, you thresh barley. And when you go back, you harvest wheat, and you put these shocks or these sheaves, you bring them into your barn, and they can stay in those sheaves until you're ready to process it. You can process those sheaves on into winter. So the issue of why he was doing barley if they're getting married 4 months after she arrived is because this is a community operation. Down where I live, there's an old cotton gin. Called the Yostown Cotton Gin. It was put in there by Colonel Yost. And Colonel Yost was a deputy, a U.S. Marshal for Judge Isaac Parker, the hanging judge. And he started his own town. You know what you had to do to start a town back then? Get yourself a cotton gin and every farmer would show up. You know why? Nobody can go out and buy their own cotton gin. So he bought a cotton gin. Now, if you got a cotton gin, you know what else you need? You need a cotton storage facility. Because when everybody's picking cotton, they're going to take it there, and Mr. Yost is going to give them a receipt and say, I have 100 pounds of cotton. When this guy's cotton's done, and that guy's cotton's done, and that guy's cotton's done, I'll do your cotton. And then I'll give you a receipt for how much cotton has been ginned. Well, here in this text, you can only use this threshing floor when it's your turn to use the threshing floor. And when you use the threshing floor, you can only use it when the wind is right. And typically, the wind's not right until right before dark, because you're a coastal town. You're a coastal region around the Mediterranean. And you know how the wind blows on the coast. You can only do this when the wind's not blowing too hard, or every time you throw a shovel load of barley up in the air, not only the chaff, but the barley will blow away. So typically what would happen is somebody would stay with this pile of wheat there to keep other people from stealing it, and I don't know if they had coons in Israel back then, but they had something like a coon that would come out at night and eat any grain you had laying around. If you lay a sack of corn in my front yard where I live at, just lay it down there and walk away. Go inside. Leave it unattended. Put the dogs up. I can assure you that thing will be torn to shreds. There will be coon tracks all over my yard, and the coons will find it. They have a way of smelling that corn. So somebody has to stay the night there to run the Israel version of coons off. Someone has to stay the night there to make sure that somebody living close doesn't come up and take what they got. And that person is typically the owner. And so, who's there? Boaz, their kindred, their near kinsman, he's there on the threshing floor. Now, let's think about this. He's there to guard it. And this is the time in which we're dealing with. It's nighttime. We're talking about the period in which we do righteous action. Someone has said, it's never the wrong time to do what's right. And I think that's true. It's never the wrong time to do what's right. That's an easy question. Here's the hard question. At what point in time do you know what's exactly right to do? Let me give you an illustration of that. Marriage. Marriage. How do you know it's the right one? Don't give me a love at first sight story. I've heard them a lot as a preacher. Pastor Smith, would you marry us? Well, I don't do a lot of weddings. I turn most of them down. Well, you should marry us. Why should I marry you? We met last week and fell in love. You're laughing, but I've heard this story more than once. We met last week and fell in love. And I said, okay, you met last week and you fell in love. Well, how do you know this is love? Well, we're perfect for each other. I'm like, in a week, you don't even know each other. You're not in a position to make the right decision. You don't know this is the right one yet. It takes time to figure that out, does it not? I'm not saying you might fall in love with a woman and over time she might be the right one. And enough people get together, somebody might occasionally marry the right one on the first day they meet. But over time, the statistics will bear me out. And in our country, 50% of them don't last. It takes time. There's a period in which you have to arrive and say, this is when we should get married. Now that we both know each other. When me and my wife started dating, I liked her. She didn't really care for me. After about 6 months, she started to care for me, and I kind of got tired of her. There was a little narrow window there where we were somewhat attached to each other. And she said, hey, I think you and I ought to be serious with one another. And I was like, well, I just thought we'd given that up. I thought it was over. No. So we decided, okay, we'll be serious with one another. Within a few months, I realized the only thing I didn't like about her was I didn't think she liked me. And so we were serious and we were engaged. You see, you go from courtship or dating, whichever one you do, you go from that to engagement. We were engaged for 9 months. Now, that engagement was another time of serious evaluation. And then on the day of the wedding, the preacher demanded of me and her a very famous and common response at a wedding. You know what it is? I do. Do you so-and-so promise to so-and-so to so-and-so? I do. Do you so-and-so promise to so-and-so? I do. You see what that is? That is the right period of time to take action. Here is the right period of time to take action. Now, there's never a wrong time to do what's right, but oftentimes it takes a while to figure out what's right. What took place during barley harvest? What took place during wheat harvest? During this 4-month time frame, Ruth got to see Boaz a lot. And Boaz got to see Ruth a lot because they worked in the same field day in and day out. And what else happened? Naomi got to realize, hey, we didn't come back to Bethlehem to lay down and die. God's not through with us. He's going to take care of us. During this 4-month time frame, Naomi's heart was changed. During this 4-month time frame, Ruth's heart was changed. During this 4-month time frame, Boaz's heart was changed. When the time is now, and you know it's now, and you know it's right, it's time to take action. I'm not telling you to go rushing off doing something stupid. I'm not telling you to make rash decisions. I'm telling you, when the time is right, act. When you're 100% certain, act. If you know it's right and you know it needs to be done, what in the world's stopping you? That brings us to verse 3. Preparation. Preparation. Verse 3, we're going to understand and kind of get an idea that there's a right thing to do. There's a right time to do it. There's also a right way to do it. And so in the preparation, we're going to see that when we do things the right way, we need to take care of everything on our end and make preparation so that if it doesn't work, we're not to blame. It's not our own fault. We want to, if you will, put the odds in our favor. Verse 3 says this, "Wash thyself, therefore, and anoint thee, and put thy raiment upon thee, and get thee down to the floor. But make not thyself known unto the man until he shall have done eating and drinking." Now, I want to deal with these three words, wash, anoint, and raiment. I would say the first one is obvious. Wash yourself. Anytime you're going to go do business with someone, be as clean as possible. If you're going to ask someone to marry you, I would say don't crawl out from underneath your car or go weed eat the yard or till the garden beforehand unless you're planning on washing yourself in between then and then. If you were going out on a date with your favorite girl, wouldn't you at least factor in a little time between work and theirs to clean up? This may seem obvious to most of us, but I can assure you it's not obvious to everyone. I don't think this is to imply that Ruth was a dirty person. I think this is a preparation to go from field worker to a marriage contract. You'll find that I dress differently depending on what I have to do each day, right? On Sunday, I tend to wear slacks and a button-up long-sleeve shirt. On Wednesday nights, I tend to wear a button-up shirt and jeans. If you come by here tomorrow, I'm liable to be in a pair of shorts and a camouflage t-shirt. You know why? The preparation that I make is determined by what I plan to do. And if you're planning to approach someone about marriage, I highly suggest you start with washing. And at this time, she says, anoint thyself. If there's any Pentecostals in the group, she doesn't mean dabble a little olive oil in a cross shape on your forehead. In this arid country, before the days of deodorant and Jergens hand lotion, before the days of ChapStick and Carmex, you had to have some way of moisturizing your skin. And the only option you had was olive oil. And so what you would do after you had washed all the dust and the dirt off is you would take oil and put it on a cloth and rub it over your skin as a way of moisturizing your skin, as a way of protecting your skin from getting chafed. Have any of you ever wore wool pants? Huh? My dad found a bargain at the Army Surplus. Son, these are 100% wool. They was wool pants from like the Swiss Army. We got these babies for $2. We'll never go cold again. Yeah, we'll never walk straight-legged again either. What do you think these people made their clothing out of? Cotton wasn't around. What was it? Wool. And they wore wool garments when? In the summertime. I'm going to tell you something. Probably the best part of taking a bath. This would have been the Calgon commercial of its day. Someone daubing olive oil on their skin and rubbing it in. This would not only function to soothe dry and achy skin, it would also function as a deodorizer because there is no deodorant and a perspirant. This is a way of cleaning up and making yourself presentable and to look as good as possible. Now let's deal with the word raiment. And put thy raiment upon thee. Well, my stars, has she been going around naked? Was this her Sunday clothes? You know, I heard a preacher here about a month ago. He said, bless God when you go to church, you put on your Sunday clothes. Well, I said I wear clothes based upon what I'm doing that day. But listen to me. Do you think that Ruth and Naomi traveled with a wardrobe back from Moab? Do you think they had a finger hooked in a bunch of coat hangers walking back across the desert, carrying all them great dresses they had? Let me tell you something. Unless you were a very, very, very wealthy person, you had exactly one pair of clothes. One pair of clothes. That was all you had. You wore them every day. Well, what is she telling her to put her raiment on? Well, this word raiment is in the Hebrew is used in other places to mean cloak, mantle, or coat. It's an outer garment. You see, you had an inner garment, your tunic. It's what they called it in the New Testament. Remember when Jesus was crucified, they tore his garments, but when they got to his underwear, it was fancy underwear. It was all one piece. They said, oh, don't tear that. You don't find one piece underwear anymore. And they cast lots for the one piece. So you had a one piece, you had a covering, and then you had, in this instance, raiment that went over you. Typically had a hood. Typically would be pulled up to protect you from wind or rain or even sun. And so what she's instructing her to do in this verse is not to go put her Sunday clothes on because she doesn't have Sunday clothes. What she's instructing her to do is not to get dressed because she's been naked. She's saying you're going out after dark and you want to do it discreetly, so you better get covered up. Take your coat. Now, why would she say take your coat? Because if you've been working in the field all day and you have one pair of clothes, if I wore this shirt and these pants and these shoes every day, you could spot me a mile away. And if you all had that exact shirt on, after seeing you for 4 months, I would say, there's Sarah in her darker blue shirt than Larry in his lighter blue shirt. You know why? I would associate the clothes with the face. By wearing raiment, a dark jacket, an overcoat, it would disguise who she was. It would keep other people from recognizing her. So, it's not what you do, but it's how you do it. And what's being said here is, maybe we need to do everything to put it all in our favor. Put everything in your favor. As much as depends on you, take care of that. We can't control what other people do. We can't control how they receive us. We can't control what they think of us. But we can do all that we can to put our best foot forward and remove any opportunity for not being accepted. So then she gives her this instruction in the preparation. She says in verse 3, but make not thyself known unto the man until he shall have done eating and drinking. Because some commentaries say that Naomi's hoping that Boaz gets a little drunk at dinner time and he'll, you know, be a little more prone to saying I do. You know, a lot of men have claimed to go to bed drunk and wake up married. And that may be the case for some men, but I don't think drunkenness is involved here. I don't think that Naomi is saying, wait till he's good and drunk and then go talk to him. Now, we do know that drinking does accompany marriage, and it always accompanies it in a bad way. You remember when Jacob got drunk on his wedding night and woke up with the ugly sister-in-law instead of the one he agreed to marry? Now, drinking was a common place, and it was a common practice. There's no indication here that Boaz was ever a drunkard. So why would she say, wait till he's eaten and drank? Well, it's a matter of approaching him at the right time. Do any of you still have a home phone? Have any of you ever had a home phone? Some of you had the ones that said, ring, Mabel, give me number 7, or BR549, right? Bob, you might have had a soup can and a string. I don't know, down in Mena. Remember when you had a home phone? You remember back before that law where you could make it where telemarketers couldn't call you? You remember what happened every evening about 6:30? The phone would ring. You'd be sitting down to eat supper with your family and the phone would ring. And we would be around the table and my dad would say, would one of you kids get the phone? And I would go answer the phone and they would say, is Harold Smith there? And I would say, this is him. I'd like to speak to your father, because his name was Harold Smith too. I'd say, Dad, it's for you. And what my dad learned real quick, who is it? And I would say, who is it? And he would say, this is so-and-so from the Mel Harris Siding and Window Company. I would say, it's somebody trying to sell siding, Dad. Not right now, we're eating dinner. It didn't mean not right now, it meant not never. But invariably, these people knew not to call during the day because you weren't home. They knew to call when you got home. And when you got home, the last thing you wanted to hear while you were eating supper or talking to your wife or helping your kids with homework was what? You didn't want somebody at that time interrupting you. Or what about these people that go door to door selling stuff? You're sitting in there watching your football game, doorbell rings. You get up to go see who it is. Hello, sir, would you like to buy a subscription to magazines? You remember those people that sold magazine subscriptions? Now, if I didn't have anything else going on, and there was literally nothing else to do in my day, and I was just twiddling my thumbs, I might listen to the spiel. I might even buy a magazine. But if you caught me there in the middle of Razorback LSU football, I'm not watching. I'm not talking to you. You might get the door slammed. No thanks. Bam. If she were to show up while the crew is winnowing barley and say, Boaz, I'd like to talk to you about my future. Bad time. If she would be to walk up at dinner while everybody's sitting around eating and drinking together and say, excuse me, could you come over here? We need to talk marriage. Wrong time. It's not only because it's the wrong time. I think a wrong time, the easiest way to describe it probably be this. As a preacher, people like to inform me when we run out of toilet paper. I don't know what that has to do with being the preacher. The very first church I pastored, there was four women that cleaned the church. And I'm telling you what, these ladies cleaned it. I mean, they cleaned it like big time. You couldn't touch nothing. Don't touch a broom. Don't touch. But they wouldn't touch toilet paper. And so we would do Sunday school. Sunday school was over. We have 10 minutes. People are coming in. I'm trying to meet new visitors and whatnot. I look at my watch. It's time for church to start. I've got to go get in the pulpit. Brother Harold, we're out of toilet paper. I'm like, okay, we're going to start singing here in about 30 seconds. Well, could you go before you start church and get some more toilet paper? And I'm like, well, I kind of get paid to preach. I kind of get paid to be the pastor. I'm not above getting toilet paper. But right now, it's not very high on my list of things to do. Hold it. Or go get your own toilet paper. It's not that I don't want to go get toilet paper. It's bad timing. More than bad timing also is the prospect of embarrassment. When I was a kid, we could not bring another kid with us to ask my mom and dad if they could stay the night. Parents, you ever experienced that? We would not allowed to bring another kid with us and say, can we go to their house and stay the night? Why? Because my parents didn't mind telling me no, because they were used to it. They weren't used to telling the other kid no. They weren't used to saying, no, you can't. And they didn't want that kid to feel bad. They didn't want to embarrass him in any way. They didn't want to say, no, he can't come over and stay the night. We're leaving at 6 o'clock in the morning to go, you know, to grandma's house. Instead of having to divulge our entire family business in front of a kid I wanted to come over, they would say, the answer is no if you ask in front of other children. We passed that same law on to our kids. It's easy to tell them no when there's no risk of embarrassment and also no risk of being forced into something you really don't want to do. Last night at Grace in Ozark, Jim had a migraine. After he got off work, he went straight home. He leads the singing every Tuesday night. And so Carol said, well, are you going to lead singing? I said, oh, no. No, I'm not going to do that. I said, as a matter of fact, I think what we'll do is we'll just start Bible study. And they said, well, does anybody want to lead singing? Now, I know that Carol can play the keyboard we got there. And I know that her daughter, Hannah, can really sing. But for me to ask Hannah, do you want to sing, would have done one of two things. It would have embarrassed her that she had to say, no, I don't want to lead singing. Or it would have forced her into doing something she really didn't want to do in order to keep everyone else happy. Nobody was interested in singing. And I said, okay, we'll start. She said, well, I don't mind to do it. I said, okay, get up here. You see, if you're going to go ask someone to marry you, don't be like these idiots on America's Funniest Home Videos. You know, they get their girlfriend out in front of a large crowd of people. They make a big show. They say, will you marry me? And everyone's looking at them and they go, no, I'm not marrying you. And then here's a guy with a ring in front of a girl and all of his friends, and nothing happened. The reason you wait till Boaz is done is because you want to do things at the right time, the right way. You want to put it all together. You want to make preparation for when you act, that you act the right way. Now, this doesn't mean that we need to be timid and can't make quick decisions when quick decisions need to be made. But this is not a quick decision. This is, will you provide a child for me? Will you provide for me and my mother-in-law? This is not to say this is an instant thing that needs to be done now or never. This is something that needs to be thought about. Preparation needs to be made to put our best foot forward, to show humility. So here leads us to verse 4, the plan. The last two verses are not nearly as long as the first three, so you can groan a little if you need to. Verse 4, and it shall be, when he lieth down, that thou shalt mark the place where he shall lie. And thou shalt go in and uncover his feet and lay thee down, and he will tell thee what thou shalt do. Now the plan is to watch where he lies down. This is where he would lay down and go to sleep. Now, we are in Israel. It's basically a rock pile of mountains and valleys. If you're laying there with a pile of straw, barley straw, and you're laying there with a pile of barley seed, and you're laying there with a pile of rocks, where are you sleeping at? You going to pull the George Washington and use snow for your blanket and a rock for your pillow? No. If you've ever been around a big pile of seed, it's actually kind of fun to sleep in, lay down in. And it's like a form-fitting mattress before form-fitting mattresses existed. You crawl up on top of a truckload of a pile of corn, just wiggle a little bit, and you can get in any position that a sleep comfort bed can get into. She says, figure out where he lays down and goes to sleep because it's fixing to get dark. It's fixing to get dark before flashlights, before hard wax candles, before lanterns. All she would have for light after dark would be moonlight and starlight or a torch. That's real nonchalant, isn't it? You're carrying a torch. Or she would have what the Bible calls them candles, but they're actually lamps. Have you ever seen a lamp from this period of time? It basically consists of a bowl about yay big around with a pour spout on one end. And you would fill that with oil. And you'd lay a little wick in there. And it would make a flame about the size of my fingernail. And you'd have to carry it level so the oil didn't slash out. And you'd have to walk and shield it. And so she says, get down there before it gets dark. Let him eat. Let him drink. Let all the work get finished. Mark where he goes to sleep. And then when he lies down, go up there and uncover his feet and lie at his feet. Now, I want to say something here because I thought the text was pretty self-explanatory there. What do you envision Ruth doing? Walking up there to a guy laying on a pile of seed or in a pile of straw with a blanket, some kind of a covering over. I see her walking up there, grabbing that blanket and flipping it off his feet and then laying down there, kind of making an upside-down T to you. Is that what you envision? There are people here that say she never got near his feet. She never touched his feet. And the reason they're saying that is because they think that Ruth was actually trying to do something sexual here. There's nothing sexual happening down at the foot of the bed, okay? And so in order to make Ruth look above reproach, they actually make it out like nothing ever really happened. And then there was one commentary I read that said, where his feet are is really another word that means pillow. Although they didn't give any illustration of that. What Ruth was told to do was go and put her head on his pillow. I thought, my stars, we've got one guy saying she never touched his feet because you don't touch the foot of a sleeping man if you're a single woman. We got another commentator saying, no, she put her head on his pillow. When I think the text is pretty clear, she uncovered his feet and laid down. Now, why would she do that? Well, this is an ancient tradition of a younger woman going to an older man and propositioning marriage. Because Ruth is not your typical bride, right? Who typically gives the bride away in a wedding? Her mother and I. It's usually what the dad says, right? Where's her dad? He's in Moab. Where's her father-in-law? He's dead. Why is she approaching Boaz? Because she's been married before and he's kin to her. This is a way of a woman quietly and discreetly going to a man and having a conversation in private yet in public. Remember what we said about this threshing floor? It was public property where everybody did their stuff. It wouldn't be wrong for a man and a woman to be together in a public place. What's the purpose of uncovering the feet? Same thing that happens when you uncover anybody's feet in their sleep. If they're cold, they wake up. And if you're sleeping on a pile of straw or hay and all of a sudden your feet are cold and you wake up and the first thing you try to do is do the kick, kick some covers back over. The problem is this hasn't been naturally undone. This has been intentionally unfolded. When all the moving around and shaking, you have to figure out what in the world's wrong with these covers. When I laid down, they covered my feet. Now they don't. And you sit up and imagine the startle and the shock. There's somebody laying down by your feet. Not next to you, not in your face like this. That's fun to do sometimes when someone's waking up. Just get over about 3 inches from their nose and eyeball them. Now have your dukes up because they may swing. That's not what happened here. He woke up with his feet uncovered. And there he would look and see a woman. Now here's the deal. These two people are in the cover of darkness in a private place. in a private setting, yet in a public place. This is the perfect opportunity to discreetly ask someone and proposition them for marriage without the risk of embarrassment, without the risk of forcing someone's hand, with the opportunity to discuss things. If she had walked up and carried on this discussion in the field, it would have been bad. If the servants of Boaz would have let her into Boaz's bedroom to talk to him in private, everybody on the staff at Boaz's house would go, "What in the world are Ruth and Boaz doing back there?" But since she came in discreet, let everyone bed down for the night, privately goes to him in a public place and approaches him and sits at his feet, not in a way to tempt him, not in a way to seduce him, not in any kind of a sexual manner, but in a way of showing humility. "I'm here at the foot of the bed and I need to talk to you." What says? Verse 4 says, "And he will tell thee what thou shalt do." This is not a slam dunk. This is not a guarantee. As we find out when this takes place, there's somebody else that's a closer kin to her than Boaz. So all this is Ruth going to Boaz and saying, "I am willing to marry you. Are you willing to marry me? I'm willing and would love for you to be my kinsman redeemer and provide a child for my father-in-law and my husband who are dead and have no children. Are you willing?" This is a way of putting your righteousness into action and also at the same time allowing someone else to accept or reject what needs to be done. This is to give a private response. This is a public place, so it's not wrong. It's not sexual. It's not. If anything took place here, if anybody hollered, if anything happened, there were other people around guarding their stuff as well. This is something that is right to do. This is the right time to do it. And this is the right way to do it. So when everything is right, what does Ruth say? Verse 5 is performance. "She said unto her, all that thou sayest unto me, I will do." Ruth, after hearing what Naomi says and understanding the plan, says, "All of this is perfectly acceptable. All of this is the right way to go about it. All of it. There's not one part of this plan that I would change." Why? Because she loves Boaz. Because she has a feeling that Boaz loves her. Because she has a trust in her mother-in-law, Naomi. Because of the way that they're doing it. Because of the preparation that's gone into it. Because of the period and time in which they're at. Everything is right. Folks, the point of the entire passage is this. When we take action, it needs to be a righteous action. You can do the right thing the wrong way, and you can do the wrong thing often. But when we act as Christians, when we make deliberate things, when we approach people for a decision, we should approach them in the best, most proper way possible. We should look at the plan of Naomi and Ruth, and we should recognize that all we're simply doing is propositioning this person to do what they feel like God has designed them or commissioned them or made available to them to do. And so that's the way you and I should put righteousness into action. So it's one thing to say we don't do this and we don't do that. It's another to say, what do we do and how do we do? I pray God would help us to do it like Ruth and Naomi do the right way.